This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Josh Seidner. We're going to be discussing the book Bobos in Paradise by David Brooks. Josh, great talking to you.
Yeah, once again, it's great to be on the show with yourself and Matthew. Very honored to be here.
So on the topic of Bobos, I just got back from Whole Foods, which pretty much is the ultimate Bobo establishment, and I had for dinner bratwurst and sauerkraut.
Excellent.
Yeah, kind of, third worldism.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's
exactly.
A lot of products there. As it says in the movie, Fight Club, like, you know, made by the indigenous peoples of wherever.
Right, like quinoa, or, you know.
And I like quinoa, organic, but yeah, probably, it's, yeah.
I guess like, the organic term is probably, you know, the key operative.
All of us basically kind of overlap with this demographic. We overlap with it, but we're all, at the same time, we're sort of outsiders of it at the same time, but we're interconnected to it, which creates an interesting dynamic.
Well, and I mean, often people that are like that are usually the biggest threats, you know, and certainly I'm sure there's somebody out there watching things that knows that and is looking for those kinds of outlier people who know the inner workings of... you know, the privileged class, but are not quite in it for a variety of reasons. It may have been that they were rejected. It may have been that they left voluntarily. It may have been that something about them didn't quite fit. You know, any of those things are possible.
Yeah, that's definitely for sure. And we'll definitely get to that. I just want to give a kind of a basic introduction. So Bobos is the concept of David Brooks. I'm not sure if he coined the term, but it's a hybrid of the two terms, bourgeois and bohemian. So basically, Bobos are capitalists, neoliberal hippies.
Or hipsters, right, is another way of saying it.
Hipsters are the millennial offshoots. The original Bobos were the boomers in the 90s who were yuppies in the 80s, but originally part of the hippie counterculture in the 60s. Josh, do you want to give some background information on David Brooks? So he was kind of a neocon who supported George Bush, and then he was like the token conservative for the New York Times, and then part of the Never Trumper. So, I mean, he's definitely not one of us, but I do think he has a lot of things to say that are insightful.
Right, and if you read Brooks, you know, you see... Have you guys ever heard of the term Atlantic accent before?
Yeah, it's sort of a... It's sort of an accent of the upper class, right. WASP elite. I'm not sure if it's more, is it more New England or more like Virginia, Maryland?
It's definitely a New England thing. And, you know, it was a term that was used in the early 20th century. It used to describe a way of speaking English that was not quite American, you know, and not quite British, you know, so they don't have an unmistakable British accent, but it's British enough so that, you know, other Brits, you know, where the money was, you know, can see these markers of affluence. And, you know, so you have this, like, old money, this American old money group, and Brooks is very much part of that. And I think for people certainly who were born after 1970, that group really very much disappeared. And, you know, the millennials especially are very unacquainted with that kind of culture that sort of, it either disappeared or it morphed or changed its appearance sometime after the 60s, you know, which is roughly what the book is about. You know, there's some things that I disagree with the book, you know, the way that Brooks sort of writes about things, but there's a lot of it certainly was very prophetic. You know, he goes into details about this, about how the Bohemians, who were supposed to be these idealists, very much associated with Marxist ideals, somehow crossbred with the bourgeois, you know, who were the enemies of the Marxists. You know, I mean, Brooks is definitely coming from that. In a lot of ways, he was really the last of the Mohicans. You know, he's really the only writer I can think of that sort of, like, carried, you know, some of those ways of looking at the world into the 70s and 80s in a way that's at least somewhat historically contiguous, right? And he, you know, he wrote this book. He did a lot of other things, you know, Bobos in Paradise. And that's basically what it's about. It's about how this group morphed and changed into something that resembled the hippie movement, you know. And I suppose there's a lot of different ways that we can go from there, and I know you mapped out a couple before.
There was this backlash against Reaganomics in the 80s era. It became kind of like there was this era, the 80s were associated with hyper-materialism, and during the early 90s recession, there was some resentment against the wealthy and against Reaganomics, so a lot of these people wanted to reinvent themselves. And then this basically the cultural trend of the Bobos, so it coincided, the Clintonite neoliberal hijacking of the left.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, let's put it into even better context. You're sort of taking out what happened in the 70s with Carter. You know, so before Reagan, there was Carter. And Carter's policies were exactly the opposite. I mean, he focused on minority groups. That was probably his standard. He was the standard bearer for that. You know, he's the one who took these minority politics and brought them to the national sort of establishment. So really, Reagan was a response to all of these things that had happened. You know, an interesting aspect of the 80s were a group called the Reagan Democrats. Yeah, so there was this group called the Reagan Democrats, and this was a group that supposedly, you know, they were essentially Democrats in their DNA, you know, very often non-WASP people, and they sort of switched sides over to the Republicans during the Reagan election, and that's what resulted in the landslide victory for Reagan in California. So, you know, there was a lot of shifting going on, like, you know, a lot of ideology and values that were changing. That's really somewhat difficult to map out, you know, exactly what had gone on. You know, it had very much to do with the boomers. You know, suddenly, I think, as you noted, you know, we had a time when the boomers went very much from like a socialist mindset, as in we need to redistribute the wealth, to this like everybody deserves what they get, or, you know, hard work is the key to success. You know, that was kind of a change in their attitude, which unfortunately, you know, these attitudes also empowered the very, very wealthy, you know, the Koch brothers of the world. And those people, you know, they profited from this change in attitude, which the boomers felt was going to benefit them. And they essentially just took complete control of the economy since then. You know, you can look at the numbers in terms of wealth disparity, and it's become progressively more horrific since the 80s or 90s.
So basically both Bohemians and the bourgeoisie, those were concepts that emerged after the French Revolution?
Right. At least that's how Brooks sort of outlines, you know, where these people came from. And if I recall correctly, Marx actually had a little bit of a different take on it. You know, he outlined the rise of the bourgeois, you know, after the Renaissance, I believe. But don't quote me on that. So yeah, that's basically what Brooks says. You know, he says that after the French Revolution, you know, the nobility was, you know, they essentially decapitated the French society, and that left, you know, the priesthood and the merchant class, and those two people sort of seized power. You know, there's quite a number of stories about what happened to the clergymen after the French Revolution. Many of them were killed by the revolutionaries, but some of them sort of moved into different organs of the state and, you know, the emerging academia and became this new character that you find in French society today, which is like this philosopher. You know, French are very much into this character called the philosopher, and you know, he's like a prophet almost. He tells everybody how they're supposed to live and how society's supposed to be, and then you know the French talk about it and consider it. They're very much into this idea of like discussing these deep ideas, and then you know they try to shape their social policy around that stuff.
Those are some historical origins that Brooks discusses. So you were talking about Reagan and this generation of boomers who were youth during the 60s era. So with the whole 80s yuppie culture, whatever you can say about it, it was very much upfront and honest about what it was all about.
Well, I mean, one thing that I observed when the 90s rolled around was like this complete and total erosion of like workplace standards and like the concept of work. You know, this idea that, you know, what exactly are roughly, you know, generally, what are your obligations to employers, how you're supposed to treat them, how the employer is supposed to treat you, you know, what your expectations should be, and how the employer is going to meet those expectations. All those things were literally like thrown out the window in favor of this, what they were sort of championing. They were saying this was a really great thing that was going to happen, you know, that everyone was going to be this freelancer and we'd be like these happy little bees buzzing around, you know, and we'd find a little flower and then like pollinate it, and then suddenly the entire country would be this like this great Garden of Eden, you know, with endless wealth. You know, I mean, I've never even witnessed a single year of that, let alone, you know, anything close to what the promises of that were. So what happened was, you know, all this concept of employment got completely eroded. The boomers ignored the whole thing because most of them were on the tail end of their careers anyway. They didn't need it, and they had enough capital saved up that, you know, maybe some of them were smarter and could see these changes happening and knew they could no longer rely so much on their employment situation. Then they moved their money into real estate, and we all know what happened there. But you know, I found like that the boomers, you know, they're very hypocritical. You know, they changed their story considerably from the time that they were, you know, in their late teens to 20s when they're talking about equality and socialism, and the moment that they sort of get established, then the story changes to basically Reaganomics. And I mean, I hear them say F the unions all the time, you know, as if they're the enemy.
If you go back to the original 60s counterculture, it was much more, I mean, there were certainly a lot of legitimate issues like fighting against the Vietnam War, but the overall cultural aspect was much more about having a cultural revolution against their parents' generation than it was about economic inequality. Because they came from an era of prosperity, so their main rebellion was about culture, not so much an economic rebellion, so that was their cultural origins. And then they went on to become prosperous.
And it's also the question of, you know, what, you know, did the elites, you know, the very, very wealthy, poison some of these movements as well? That's also, I think, a fairly valid question, certainly not one that not only I myself have asked before. You know, like, how did this, you know, during the 60s, especially coming, you know, like leading up to maybe like 1967, you know, the very, very wealthy were legitimately concerned that America was going to turn, like the system was going to turn on its head, you know, kind of like this, the environment that we have today where people are really starting to think, you know, there's going to be a turnover of government here. You know, we're going to have a military coup and things are just going to go crazy. You know, keep in mind that, you know, before Martin Luther King, you know, you had all those civil rights things. You know, there were periods where some of these people were literally like burning down cities in the South. It was a real civil disorder scenario, and you know, the very wealthy people who still own this country were extremely concerned about that. You know, it wasn't just a bunch of rich kids from the suburb, white rich kids from the suburbs smoking pot. That's not what the 60s was about. And you know, often millennials, you know, people who sort of you know, arrived, were born much later, you know, they look back at that time as a bunch of people who just sort of were doing drugs and having sex and stuff, but there's a hell of a lot more to the 60s than that. So I tend to think, you know, that maybe we focus on those aspects of the 60s because that's what, you know, they want us to focus on. They want us to think that, you know, this decade was really about drugs and fun and essentially just being a degenerate, when really that's not what it was about.
Well, yeah, definitely. Unfortunately, that is what it's remembered for in very, like, kitschy kind of media still gets produced that references that ideal of the 60s. But, I mean, I've done some research on it. I've long been fascinated by the 60s. And, I mean, there definitely was a lot of genuinely radical thinking going on. People were studying, you know, the Frankfurt School and even people like Mao. I mean, there's a lot of economic leftism, in other words. But what the legacy of the 60s is pretty much entirely in terms of social liberalism, and that kind of did fuse with the economic conservatism in the 80s.
Right, and how much of that was these Bobo characters, you know, who sort of were really essentially imposters, and, you know, they basically own the media, and those are the points that they choose to focus on. You know, like, to them, 60s was Woodstock, it was a bunch of rock concerts, it was, you know, some burning of bras, and a couple of other, you know, in my view, very trivial kinds of movements, when, you know, they totally ignore the real meat and potatoes of what actually was happening in the 60s. You know, there's another factor to the 60s that also is commonly ignored, which is what was going on in the USSR at the time. You know, the people who were leading our country during the 60s were absolutely terrified of the threat of the USSR and what it really meant, you know, to the American program. You know, a lot of people view America in different ways. You know, some people you might ask, they'll tell you that, you know, we're the homeland of freedom. Other people
will say,
"Well, yeah,
that is part of the reason, because that there were these economic populist policies implemented. I mean, starting with the New Deal, so there was concern that there would be a backlash against the elites, either in a communist direction or like left-wing populism. But there was also concern about right-wing populism or rise of fascism, basically directed against the elites. So they realized they needed to provide. So, whatever you think about FDR's motives, there was a concession to the people of the country, and Eisenhower kind of continued that legacy, and then it was continued to some degree to the 60s, and gradually it started to get chipped away, and Reagan, I mean, things started to get really bad under Reagan and Clinton and both Bush Sr. and the more recent George Bush. So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of it, yeah, it did got gradually chipped away. And then now we have these issues now. One interesting point with this whole Bobo phenomenon is the elites morph into basically something different by changing their appearance. So, as you were talking about in the beginning, Josh, we have this obscene amount of income inequality. What's really fascinating is there is less cultural contrast. So Josh, what were your sort of observations? You grew up, well, you were a kid in the 80s, which was before this whole phenomenon. So you grew up in the North Shore of Long Island around a lot of wealth. So what were some of your observations about the cultural differences between the wealthy and middle class that have kind of been blurred more recently?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I noticed changed over the years, certainly, was, you know, during the 80s, and I was very young at the time, but you could still sort of detect it, that there was a very clear sense of, you know, who this group of very wealthy was, and we knew that they were, we were opposed to them. You know, there wasn't really any question that, you know, who was the good guys and who were the bad guys, right? And, you know, by the time the 90s rolled around, all of those lines got severely blurred. And, you know, finally, the millennial generation arrived. These kids don't even seem to understand even anything about, you know, what they're reading or who's even writing it. Yeah, and that's a really important thing. I mean, I noticed, you know, with the rise of social media, like, the whole notion of authorship has been almost completely removed. People don't really seem to care who is saying what they're reading. They're only really interested in sort of picking apart the logic. You know, does it conflict with my logic, or does it not conflict with my logic? I think Aristotle said, you know, that a convincing argument rests on three main things, and that's pathos, logos, and the most important one, ethos. You know, who are you listening to? And I think that had a lot to do with it. You know, a lot of the changes in who could say what, you know, who could say something to the public, or who is able to say it anonymously, or you're allowed to say it through proxies. Even our media ownership laws changed dramatically, roughly around the late 90s. I think we've discussed that before, the DMCA. That was really only one policy in a collection of policies that was a total reordering of the way that our media worked. We had a lot of strict laws about who could own things. You know, you weren't allowed to monopolize the media in a given place. And there were laws about if somebody wanted to open up an independent newspaper, for instance, then there were certain laws that would help them to do that. All those things were removed in the late 90s. You know, it comes as no surprise that we're basically like living in this propaganda environment that's easily as bad as communist Russia, probably worse.
So with the whole cultural issue, there are a lot of, I mean, there's kind of the blurring of cultural distinctions. I mean,
yeah.
I'm too young to remember the 80s, but one thing from watching movies, like if you watch a movie from the 80s, they'll show wealthy people go out to a classical music concert or to the opera, when Bobo today is more likely to do something that is... Or Bobo will go to, like, you have these, like, boomers who go to Burning Man, and that's, like, the thing to do today.
Or Grateful Dead.
Yeah, well, in the 80s, it would be more likely to go, like, those types of people would go to an opera, so there's this blurring of a class. And then back in the 50s, we had more economic equality, but the class distinctions were much stronger. So it's really hard to say if it's by design, because it is very fascinating that the same era when income inequality and these policies that were implemented to basically exacerbate income inequality under neoliberalism, we saw the kind of blurring of cultural class distinctions.
Right, and I think that we mentioned perhaps this discussion about how some of these like Generation Z guys, you know, especially the alt-right, are trying to revive, you know, some of the kind of cultural forms of the upper classes prior to the Boboization. You know, they'll do things like go to like an opera or something, you know, almost in like an ironic way, or they'll grow a beard, you know, that looks like something out of the 19th century.
Oh yeah, you know, I guess people who are kind of the types of people we're talking about, and we kind of fit into this category as well. They're people who are intelligent, but they're kind of outside of that elite circle, so they're going to kind of latch on to symbols of the upper class, or even aristocracy of the past. So it could be ancient Rome, it could be 18th century European aristocracy, or it could even be the kind of the sort of fascination with 80s aesthetics and all that, the whole phenomenon. There was like a Trump wave, and then, or just the whole kind of vaporwave genre in general. There's definitely a fascination with that.
Well,
beyond that, there's also a kind of interest in futuristic aesthetics, which I also think is different than nostalgicizing the aristocracy of the past, but that's also a fascinating element as well, because both are kind of rebellions against the status quo.
Yeah, they definitely all could be understood as trying to move past this boboization of what it means to be culturally elite, because we've reached a point where that's achieved a totality where, you know, it's rich kids having like barn weddings and, you know, drinking craft beer, like all these things are kind of fetishization of not only on this like kind of lower class or class distinctions blurred, but also rural lifestyle. I mean, that's just reached a fever pitch. So, but that you do see this nostalgia in like the alt-right for various forms, whether it's opera. I mean, you see people on the Daily Storm or like Weave talking about how much he likes opera. But also, yeah, like we're talking about on this show with futurism, and even the 80s, because I think the 80s is kind of the last breath of this older, more traditional kind of elitism.
Sure, and a lot of the fashions even came, I remember them coming back in the 80s. You know, for one thing that was noticeable, I still remember this in the 80s, when the haircut suddenly completely changed. Like, they went from some variation of the 70s, which was kind of like either an afro or like semi-long hair. You know, it was very, for a while in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of males would just kind of like wear their hair like semi-long. You know, kind of like an emo cut or something, I think maybe is something you can relate to if you're a little bit younger. And then suddenly, yeah, and then suddenly, like, it all, everybody had to have this, like, military cut, you know, and they wanted it buzzed in the side. I remember going to the barber, and, like, this, I remember him obsessing over this. Do you want it, do you want your hair over your ears or not? Because, like, I guess in his world, there was a sudden dramatic shift, you know, from, like, these 70s hairstyles to, like, this military do.
Yeah, know? Or like the Hitler Youth haircut almost, not to put sharp a head on it. And that's come back, and that's a point that's interesting to me. I mean, you see, like, Richard Spencer's very famous haircut. A lot of, it's the fashy haircut that a lot of alt-right types have. But that actually became popular in the culture. Like, the guy, the lead singer of Maroon 5 had that cut for a while. So that kind of came back in the 2000s. And you wonder, I mean, I think there's an unconscious element to why some of these trends come back.
Sure. Well, what does a haircut look like that sort of denote? It's, you know, you look more kind of imposing. You know, it tends to bring out the shape of your cheekbones, and you know, there's certain kinds of, like, you know, real things that it does to your face and the way that people perceive you. I guess, which is more it's more like acceptable or more desirable under certain cultural conditions. But, you know, my point was that, you know, the 80s is just, there's a reason why, you know, all these guys are going back to the 80s, because the 80s was the last time that we had a situation like this, where, you know, certain things broke down and suddenly pockets of the population wanted almost like a form of fascism. It was really all over the place. Like, you know, I work in communications and technology, like, the FCC, like, their policy changed a lot. There was Powell, you know, he's related to the famous, the military Powell. He was the FCC chairman, and, like, his policy was against this concept of freedom of information. Mm-hmm. His argument was freedom of information actually degrades communication, and there's certainly logic in that. You know, so that kind of an idea, you know, that information should be top down, which is obviously a feature of fascist systems. That was even found in American thinking at that time. There's a lot of parallels.
Yeah, for sure.
The elite group we're talking about, they engage in fake social climbing. So they're basically conformist, but they pose as nonconformist, and they use that as a way to they use virtue signaling to climb socially. And then they play a role in guiding political discussions, and they view themselves, they're basically like these self-appointed moral leaders.
Right, and, you know, I think the key thing is here is, you know, it's like contradiction and hypocrisy. And, you know, I think I mentioned a couple of this in some of our preliminary discussions. You know, like, environmentalism is a very good example of that. You know, like, of all the values that you see in this Bobo crowd, environmentalism is easily number one. And, of course, you have things like controversial matters like carbon, you know, CO2 issues, which, depending on who you talk to, may or may not actually be a problem. But, you know, they're all seem to passionately, obsessively concern themselves with this problem of environmental degradation. And meanwhile, you know, they're like invested in Monsanto. You know, they're invested in mining operations in Africa. You know, they are the ones that are responsible for these problems. So it's, you know, it's a kind of like fig leaf, really. You know, they're covering, you know, who they really are, like what is their actual nature. And this kind of thing, this is where I sort of differ with Brooks. I don't think this is really so much of a new thing. You know, you had this, you know, all throughout Europe, you know, the middle class would often use Christian values or the semblance of Christian values, you know, as a way to kind of justify and rationalize slavery, for instance. You know, mm-hmm. like take slavery, okay? Basically for a time in Europe, a good 100 years, you know, they would go to Africa, they would take the natives there by force, they would bring them to the New World and get them to work, and then they would make profit off of that. And how did they sort of maintain their guise as as morally superior people through the use of Christianity. You know, they would pay the ministers and the priests, and the priests literally at one point the Pope would bless the slave ships as they made their way from, I think it was England, maybe perhaps Spain, and then on their way to the New World.
It is basically like a secular religion. Because it's more because, you see the same with the whole immigration issue. Massive immigration from the Third World is basically an example of capitalist exploitation, but they're able to frame it in the moral framework that they're morally
right.
superior, and people who oppose open borders and letting in all these migrants from the Third World are cold-hearted, bigoted people.
Right, it's exactly the same thing, you know. And by the way, you know, even that's not even a new thing. They used to do this in the Roman Empire, or even empires prior to Rome. They would, you know, move different cultures around, mix them up together in order to prevent uprisings. You know, that's a very old sort of technique, you know, that's existed and well documented. So even that's not even particularly new. No, and the question that motivation is really somewhat ignorant. It's very obvious why it's happening. It's, you know, to prevent solidarity.
Yeah, because if in order to have a cohesive labor movement, people, there have been cases of people, different groups working together. I'm not saying I'm opposed to that, but in a homogenous society where there's more cohesion, there's more likely to be a cohesive labor movement. Well, in a
right.
culture that it's more ethnically diverse and fragmented, then it's easier for the corporate and economic elites to exploit people. And this has also
sure.
coincided with the decline of the labor movement. As you were saying before, I think in the past, a lot of people, it was pretty obvious, a lot of people with the traditional labor movement, they felt like they were being exploited. But, a lot of people have been kind of duped into thinking by the media that there is this socially conscious elite that is looking out for them. I mean, in an ideal society, you do want an elite that has a sense of noblesse oblige, that cares about the good of a society. But we basically have the most corrupt elite in American history, but they've duped so many
easily.
People into thinking that they're socially conscious.
Sure. And, I mean, there's parallels to the church there as well, too. Obviously, the priests were posing as, you know, benevolent fathers. You know, they make sure to use the term, of all of the laity, you know, during the late Middle Ages, you know, convincing them that they're actually looking out for their best interests. You know, you have the same exact thing happening today. You know, these people are posing as our ministers of equality, or ministers of excellence, or ministers of innovation, even. And they're really doing none of those things.
So, Josh, you worked in the Silicon Valley. I think the Silicon Valley personifies this more than any other industry. So, the thing about the Silicon Valley is because, unlike with Wall Street, they weren't attached to the whole kind of baggage of the past, like the whole robber baron era and a lot of that. They were able to actually successfully invent themselves as these socially conscious industry. So there's the whole theme of we've done countless shows on the tech industry and income inequality in the Bay Area. But there's
sure.
that whole issue. Mark Zuckerberg personifies that. And there's a whole kind of aesthetic aspect of that, like the whole kind of casual work thing, where how they dress as opposed to the traditional business suits.
Well, here's a good example of that. You said like that everybody dresses casually. You know, the idea of dressing casually is, you know, you don't have to wear very expensive sorts of clothes, right? I mean, that's the concept in principle. However, you go to these places and then they're basically had cultivated a kind of fashion style where, you know, that requires investments of hundreds of dollars for a shirt in order to dress casually, which shows you, like, you know, these like idiotic.
Or there was that trend. I forget where this was, but people were spending $1,000 to buy a teared up, ripped up jeans. I forget when that was.
Oh,
maybe was that around like 2000?
Sure. that was going on when I was younger in the 80s. Oh, I remember really? That. Like, designer ripped scenes. Oh, yeah, that's old. That's very many decades old.
Yeah. I think a better example would be those shoes, Toms, for instance. I mean, I don't remember. Do you guys remember Toms?
I do roughly remember it.
I mean, that's like peak Bobo to me. I mean, those are just like the most basic shoe you can imagine. Supposedly, like, every pair you bought would donate a certain amount of money to some issue in some third world country. And yeah, they're like, I don't remember exactly how much they were, but they were like way more expensive than they look, like $80 a pop. And they were a real status symbol in like the late 2000s. But there's stuff like that that emerges.
Like, for instance, I mean, try showing up to a Silicon Valley meeting in a Walmart polo and see what happens. See how many people actually listen to what you have to say. You know, it's not really about casual. It really isn't. It's about a new set of values, and it's about different standards for maintaining those values, you know. But really, ultimately, they're the same in essence. You know, it's displaying your wealth, displaying your status. And, you know, you do it in much the same way by spending lots of money on your clothes and focusing on the brand names and same things that they used to do with Armani and, you know, any other sort of tailor.
I'm not one of those people who totally rejects having nice stuff or rejects materialism, but the important thing is you want to have stuff that is of a high aesthetic standard. And what's really disgusting is this whole notion of buying stuff purely to demonstrate status rather than the high aesthetics. In some ways, I mean, the people who are there's this kind of really like vulgar, crass materialism, but at least there's like a sense of honesty to
this.
There's
an honesty to it. Yeah,
I mean, this is really, So, with the whole hipster scene, it's basically the millennial offshoot of the Bobos, the Bobo culture. What's interesting is the boomers define themselves as rebelling against their parents' generation. So basically, they're just an offshoot of their parents.
Take a look at like Williamsburg or the Mission District. You know, like, it's filled with these people who, you know, are onerous. They're odious to virtually everybody but their own little clique. You know, we call those people hipsters, right? You know, they're notorious for their fakeness, you know, for their hypocrisy and for their duplicity. And, you know, what we just described there is very obvious. You know, there's like basically capital, you know, moving into these areas. You know, someone very, very wealthy buys out a whole bunch of buildings. Suddenly, a neighborhood that was once known as being a complete shithole is suddenly in the papers. Now it's like an up-and-coming area. Look at that, right? And then suddenly the attitudes of the police in the area change magically. You know, of course, there's no under-the-table payments going on there. And before you know, all those people own all of this expensive property, which is now cool, and their kids, who are posing as these kind of like street people, are the owners of these properties.
So, you know, yeah,
that's certainly what happened in Williamsburg.
Yeah, like, they're called Trustafarian. It's kind of this
right,
like a leisure class. And we did a whole show on this, Matt and I, about the I mean, the rule of a leisure class. And as a the people who become engaged in our culture. But the thing is, this leisure class is dominated. It's basically the children of the economic elites.
Well, part of their success at doing this, and, you know, the reason why they've successfully essentially dominated 99% of the population is through this sort of this fakeness that they have. I use an analogy. You know, there's like this insect, and I think I mentioned this to you guys before. Like, there's this insect, you know, who it like has a special adaptation. It found a way to emit like a certain kind of hormone or like a pheromone, I guess you'd call it, so that ants cannot detect that it's actually not an ant, right? And these insects, which, you know, if you look at it visually, it's very striking. Like, they're much larger than the ants. They look nothing like an ant, and they just kind of like casually stroll into these things and start eating all the ants and having a party. And it's a very similar thing. You know, like, this group of people has found a way to sort of infiltrate, you know, like cultures, I guess you'd say, cultural
values.
Yeah, because
it's flooded the kind of marketplace, and they're subsidized by by the elites, so it makes it difficult for kind of a healthier cultural competition. So the people who produce the best culture, they're not the ones being rewarded. Matt and I were doing this show about this whole issue of gentrification and urban colonization. And Matt, you can comment on this, but I think recolonizing a lot of these urban areas and building really great communities can be a great thing, and we discussed that. But there has to be a sense of honesty. I mean, we talked about it in a more kind of a positive way.
Yeah, well, I have a somewhat different take on some of this as Josh, I guess. I mean, I don't see as we were talking about in our shows on LA and San Francisco, I don't see gentrification as necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think it definitely creates conflicts, and I can understand the other side, but I fundamentally think that things like gentrification can be a great thing, new urbanism. I mean, I do think my biggest problem with, I guess, hipsters is this kind of moral veneer that has their ideology has kind of reduced to this SJWism. I do think that's fading away, and I'm interested to see what could come next.
I basically agree with that. I think because if you basically look at history, the white middle classes were driven out of urban areas and into the suburbs. So, I mean, urban recolonization is a positive thing. What we were talking about our show is advocating something that is more honest. It's more kind of these people put on this moral veneer, and it's for a very kind of a small group of people. What we're talking about actually would benefit a much larger number of people. I mean, because this kind of lifestyle in these small pockets, like Williamsburg, it's not really accessible to, like, the large numbers of middle-class whites who were driven out into the suburbs.
Hipsters are kind of the classically self-hating whites. And I think that there is something to this idea of a different group of people who have kind of moved away from that ideology and are, in fact, more okay with being white and kind of formulate. Basically, what you have... The hipster, in my opinion, is kind of a lost upper middle class, usually white, kid who's just craving authenticity and can't find it in their own culture, in white culture, and so instead, appropriates freely. Hipsters are the ones that are accused of cultural appropriation of different races. They definitely do that, but you also see them appropriating from different subculture, different white subcultures from the past. So you'll see them appropriate from the hippies, from punks, from grunge. They're just very appropriative beings. They're craving this authenticity that is like forever lost on them, and they end up looking extremely fake. And I don't know, I guess what I would advocate is I identify with that. I basically have been a hipster in my life, and I identify with that sort of socioeconomic group of people. I just think we're at a point where that old style of being of being this kind of appropriative being with this moral veneer of liberalism, I think that is truly dying, and I'm interested to see what could come next. Like, what comes after the irony? And that's a question. And, what could the new subculture be?
I agree completely with Matt here, and I was going to virtually say exactly the same thing, that, the psychological profile is much more complex than just... dad like sitting someone down like, okay, you need to look like the poor people and then report back to us 4 years from now. It doesn't really work that way. Like Matt said, there's a lot of like self out there. They have a certain sort of emptiness inside. They for some reason despise middle class mediocrity. That's a very older term, for that you would find often amongst the hippies of the 60s. They would criticize this. There's something about middle class life that they didn't like, and it's the same kind of mentality that some of these kids have.
People are craving something authentic, and I think the show we did about urbanism, we actually do address these issues. We present like a positive vision for urban life, because a lot of the problems of people are attracted to this is I'm sure Europe has a lot of Europe definitely has these same issues and cultural subcultures, and they have Bobos as well, and the hipster subculture. But I think there's something unique about America where a lot of people find just generic middle-class suburban life as being just really bland and boring. And in the past, you, as you mentioned, with the kind of a mid-Atlantic accent, like the upper classes wanted to pretend that they were European. And now the whole trend is, sure, is this kind of a third worldism, which you see with the kind of bobos and kind of fetishizing third world culture, and you see that with hipsters. With the whole kind of suburban thing, a lot of these white people, upper middle class whites from the suburbs, they feel that their lifestyle is too boring, so they present a more positive solution that does benefit middle and upper middle class white people, but it's also more positive urban aspects and maybe a culture that is more sophisticated or European or even Swipple. So we do kind of offer a positive alternative, as opposed to, because the kind of reactionary populist right, they'll criticize bobos and Swipples, but they don't really have a lot to offer.
Right. I mean, try to think deeply about where the term Trustafarian actually came from. You know, it's obviously comes from two terms, trust fund and Rastafarian, you know, and it sort of embodies exactly what you were just discussing there. Like, you know, Rastafarian is a third world. A lot of people don't really even think deeply about who Rastas really were. Like, they were a group of people that had spiritual beliefs about British imperialism, and they wanted to essentially destroy the white man. How Bob Marley and Rastafarian culture became popular with Jewish kids from Long Island is really beyond me, but you know, humanity seems to have this special.
Are you talking about that musician who's an Orthodox Jew who does reggae, or you're talking about
Modest Yahoo?
That's a good example there. Like, you know, how did he get exposed to those music styles, and how did we even arrive at the point where we think Hasidic Judaism and reggae are somehow compatible ideas? You know, they're very much not. I mean, I guess traditionally, if you really want to trace the genealogy of those two things, they're totally unrelated ideas. You know, so that's a pretty good example of what you just described. You know, they're kind of like co-opting the third world.
So basically the problem with society is we're having these large numbers of people who are getting basically left out or left behind. I mean, the obvious example is a more traditional white proletariat, and those people have been screwed over for like a very long time. But what's really important to point out is the more traditional white proletariat. I mean, the people, you could sort of say like the Reagan Democrats, but people in the Rust Belt, but going way, like the people in extreme poverty, like in the Appalachians, like they have no connection whatsoever with like bobos and Swipples. I think what is important to point out is that now there's this growing trend of a lot of people who are upper middle class background, have college degrees, including from prestigious universities. And these are actually people who are not just culturally connected, but also much closer genetically to these elites. So I think these are the people who maybe would have had potential to make it to the elite in the past, but they're being excluded either for having the wrong opinions or just not having the right social connections. So I think this group doesn't get discussed. I think it's much easier for the media to talk about the kind of stereotype of like the of these like so-called deplorables, but the people who basically like that are the stereotypical deplorables, they're not seen as much of a threat, because I think what they view as the biggest threat is not so much the white proletariat or the proletariat in general, but the idea of kind of a rival elite and a group of people who are actually linked to them culturally and genetically.
Well, I don't know if they know these people exist yet. Because, I mean, I work with people who are, you know, very anti-Trump, etc. And they're always just talking about, you know, they're always just shitting on poor white America, basically. I don't think they they certainly don't realize what the opinions I have.
Well, I would basically say that all three of us right here fit into that demographic.
Yeah, I just don't think it's very visible yet, which I think it's a rising tide.
Okay, I mean, I just want to say a couple of quick things. You know, first off, you know, a big what we were talking about before, you know, this Trustafarian phenomenon. You know, what these kids are, you know, they're pioneering because, you know, their class is just, it's crowded. You know, that's basically the problem. You know, we like to say, phrase it as, oh, well, this is such an empty world. I remember I knew a kid once. I met him, and I think it was in Phoenix or something, and he was born into a similar kind of class to me. He went to Wharton. And this kid was like this frantic lunatic about startup companies. He was a very short-statured person. And, you know, and I think maybe that was why he was particularly pronounced in his aims to become this wealthy person, because that's the only way that he would ever have status in the society that he was born into, right? So he exhibited virtually all of the things that you're mentioning here. And the thing that was driving him wasn't just like he was bored with it. It was that he wasn't really fully accepted, you know, or his position in the hierarchy was very, very low, to the point where, you know, he's probably considering, would I actually have it better if I defected and went to this other class of people and lived among them as a slightly more educated, you know, Walmart shopper or something like that, right? And, you know, which brings me to my other point. You know, this group of people, you know, there's a lot of these groups of whites in America that are never discussed. I call this place Neverland, which is like this, it's kind of like, you know, they're often suburban but lower income suburbs. And those places are growing, by the way, certainly in California.
Ars, you're not talking about the white lumpen proletariat, like the stereotype of people in trailer parks. You're talking about the kind of lower middle class people who maybe in the past they were in Southern California and they're getting pushed out to like Phoenix, more of those people.
Right. I mean, that's a very typical sort of move for this type of person. You know, they lived in California and then suddenly they found themselves unable to maintain in California, you know, an Indian got their job or something like that. And, you know, they take their bundle and then they move to Phoenix instead. So, I mean, this group of people, especially young people that are finding themselves in this spot, I mean, they are some of the most dejected of all Americans, I would say. They have it worse than illegal aliens have it in America.
Yeah, that's what makes it much worse, because the sort of traditional groups, I mean, obviously, Black people have had it pretty bad in this country, and I mean that's so obvious, you don't have to say. And the white proletariat has had it bad a pretty long time, and then the more working class whites have. They had a period where they were doing okay, and then in the 80s, their manufacturing jobs started going overseas. I mean, we're actually talking about a group of people who are pretty much. I mean, they formed basically the core of, not just people who had, like, upper middle class white-collar jobs, and in a lot of cases, these are probably people who could be maybe, like, second or third cousins to a lot of these same elites. So they're people, as I said, they're culturally and genetically linked, so that makes them actually
right.
a bigger rival than the more proletariat groups, but that also makes them a bigger threat, and they're not being discussed. I mean, I think these
right.
individuals, I mean, the stereotype of the alt-right is more that they're kind of rednecks, but actually, no, they're more, I mean, this type of group is vastly overrepresented in the alt-right. I also think this demographic makes a huge portion of the Bernie Sanders movement, and it's a growing, I mean, it is a very significant demographic group. Matthew, didn't you write one of your earliest articles on this theme?
What was that called? It was something pretentious and stupid. A Guide to Alt-Center Aesthetic Warfare, I think
was
what it was called.
Oh, right. I think that was the one where you even referenced Kevin Lynn of Progressives for Immigration Reform.
Yeah, that was an earlier attempt, an earlier stage in my development of thinking. But yeah, I mean, it was about, it was basically that general theme of kind of conceiving of a new subculture to replace
hipster subculture, basically winning people away from a sort of what I see as a very dead kind of liberal ideology toward toward something new, toward something that, you know, something that of the sort that we talk about on this show, a kind of combination of Bernie economics with you know, in a more slightly more identitarian direction.
And yeah, we've kind of addressed that on a number. Yeah, I mean, we've addressed that. That's been a major theme of this show. So I really think that people talk a lot about populism, and you definitely need populism to a degree. I mean, I think change often comes from dispossessed former members of older upper classes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, you need a kind of partnership between the proletariat and between, and also people who have access to higher society and the aesthetics and education that that can bring. And once you have those forces of society working together, that's when you have a more truly revolutionary coalition. Because the proletariat, and this I say this with sadness, the proletariat can always be quashed.
I mean, I think, like, the question is, you know, where is the discontent? You know, there's, like, this problem of we don't hear from these people. And I see them all the time. I used to live in Arizona. I currently live in Florida. And these people are all around me. It's people who have no real access to American life. You know, the sort of person who's working a service job at a supermarket or something, or they're working at Dunkin' Donuts, they have no, there's no, like, they're completely stuck in that position for life.
And that demographic is growing. I mean, there's always been poor people that have been the victims of capitalism. That's nothing new. But I guess what does seem new is this growing, I guess, kind of middle class. I mean, there was this article in The Atlantic that I posted on my Facebook a while ago about how, you know, there's this notion that a lot of people voted for Trump because of economic woes, which obviously some people did. But this article's point was that many people, that it was a more perceived existential threat. There's more of a sense, like, it's people that have means at the moment but just don't necessarily see a future for themselves or their children. They're increasingly alienated from the elite of this country. And I identify with that very strongly. And I think it's a growing group of people.
Well,
yeah, go on.
What do you believe is the answer? You know, do you have, like, a plan, so to speak? You know, I mean, a lot of people have different ideas about what to do at this point. I think we're all sort of agreement in how everything works and what the essence of the problem is. Mm-hmm. You know, but I mean, we could either go in one of two directions. We can become a more stratified, like, distinctly class-based society, right? I mean, we can't all be rich. We can't all be famous. That's impossible. You know, or we can maybe like fragment. I think that's some people's ideas. Become,
yeah, kind of pan secessionism or tribalism.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly. Like, yeah, become less of a monolithic society, because just America just doesn't work as a whole anymore. You know, there's too many. Regionalized interests. But yeah, it's kind of a tough call for me. Like, exactly what is the solution to this problem?
So yeah, that's what's happening is, I mean, a lot of those people you're talking about who are moving out to Phoenix, they're probably from kind of the more, they're from the traditional white middle class of Southern California, but the new trend now is you have people who are upper middle class and doing really well. Basically, the millennial children of the upper middle class, they're feeling a strain, and that, I mean, that's a really new phenomenon, because traditionally, the upper middle class has always had it really good. And, I mean, there's a number of different factors. There's this massive student loan debt to get into elite universities. There's a change in immigration. We're seeing a massive increase in more, like with the whole, a lot of the H-1B visas. I mean, that's a big factor. Well, I mean, one factor is education in these big urban areas where the school systems put a lot of pressure on the upper middle class to send their kids to private school. So, mean, this is this demographic that's historically had it really good. Now they're starting to feel pressure. So all these groups are under pressure. And pretty much, I mean, everyone is, except for the very tiny, like, ultra-rich, like, the top 1% or even smaller than that. There's just this very small percentage of people who have it good. And then the rest, those other people, like the upper middle class and the kind of moderately wealthy. And, I mean, Josh, as you said earlier, you kind of fit that profile in a sense that you grew up. I mean, you kind of grew up, you kind of came from that demographic.
I mean, I kind of felt like I had a bit of a crisis of conscience, really. Like, you know, I just got to a point where I concluded that, you know, this whole system was not ethical, you know, and I couldn't really operate in it, you know, 100% in the way that maybe others could.
You came at it from a very a more introspective and conscientious standpoint. I think a lot of people from that background, they'll start to feel more the economic pressure and the intense competition to make it into the very, because there's a very limited number of slots, and then they'll realize things are not working. So I think the solution for change is not so much just to be a reactionary, but actually address a lot of the cultural and economic concerns.
I would say that I don't know if this is the best way, but this is my way, because this is what I know about and what I'm somewhat good at. Is my, you know, Josh had asked earlier, you know, what I think the solution is. In terms of secessionism, I don't know what's coming with that, but subculture would be my response. I mean, I would like to cultivate, you know, collections of different values and meanings that are very compelling, and in particular aesthetically compelling, alternative to what passes for subculture in modern urban society. Because I think it's very much, I think the time is ripe for a kind of new subculture to emerge.
I definitely agree that the subculture we have now is very stale, and, you know, certainly lacks any kind of real vitamins, you know, so to use a metaphor there. Because, as we said before, you know, the people that are operating these subcultures are really not, they're like the wrong people. You know, they're coming from a different, they're coming from the elites, and they're posing as someone who's our friend, you know, has the same problems as us, when really they don't have the same problems with us. They're a completely different class of person. So I guess, I mean, authenticity is obviously the issue at hand here. You know, how do we determine what are the right, you know, for one thing, what are the right values, and how do we make sure that they're maintained properly? And that's really the culture that we should be rallying around. You know, how do we arrive at that? I don't know. Certainly it's not through social media, because social media is a big, big part of the problem.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Josh Seidner and Matthew Pegas for being on. And also, it's worth checking out that book, Bobos in Paradise, if you're interested in these topics. And that will hopefully spark further discussion.
Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.